Now, we're going to have a discussion about the European Central Bank, which is in such a crisis at the moment. The question is, how did we get to this point? And I'm joined by Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, can you just tell me a little bit about yourself first?
Well, I did economics as part of my degree many years ago, and I worked for some time for the New Economics Foundation. I worked mainly in Eastern Europe as an aid worker, and I wrote a book about the transition in Eastern Europe with a Hungarian colleague of mine, Laszlo Andor, which was published in 1998, entitled Market Failure, Eastern Europe's Economic Miracle.
Now, there's not that many economists that have been also aid workers.
No, I mean, I'm not a high-flight economist. I've never worked in the financial markets or anything like that, but I do know quite a bit about economics. I read a lot of economic history.
But we do a regular politics show here on BCFM on Fridays, Friday drive time, and the fact that you haven't actually worked full-time in the economic markets actually could be an advantage, that you're able to see it from the side.
Well, I think people who work in financial markets tend to get groupthink. Everybody thinks the same, they all tell each other the same things, and of course they can be spectacularly wrong, and you know, many times they are.
Okay, and the other thing is that many people are now talking about a possibility of, rather than just a financial dip, a kind of double dip or even a crisis as the currencies fall off the precipice. Do you think there are lessons for us now to learn from the 1929 crash and the subsequent, you know, what happened in the 30s?
Well, there are lessons to learn, but unfortunately we haven't learned them.
Well, what actually happened in 1929?
Well, in 1929, the stock market crashed, and then the economy, you know, the world economy, via America, went into depression.
This is Wall Street.
This is the Wall Street crash, which caused the depression, which went on for, you know, a decade or more in the run up to World War II.
And did that actually affect all other markets immediately?
Yes. Obviously there was a transmission mechanism, but the problem we've got now is that the bubble that we've built or blown is much bigger than in 1929. The ramifications of a bust are that much more spectacular, and the consequences are going to be fairly horrendous, I fear.
So what caused the 29 crash?
Well, what causes all crashes is the malinvestment. In other words, people basically talk stocks up, convince themselves that they're worth a lot more than they actually are, and then reality comes along and kicks them in the teeth, and the stock markets collapse. And this is the nature of capitalism. This is how it works.
Now, is it true to say that, because it's amazing, when everything sort of just goes off a precipice like that, is it a kind of overcorrection?
No, it's basically what happens when the investment cycle was over investment and profits couldn't be made, and then of course the stock market crashes and pulls down the economy with it.
I suppose that's getting worse all the time. That businesses are doing badly in a general slow recession, it means that you're kind of staving off the inevitable in a way.
Well, what's happened thus far is that the government stepped in and propped up the banking system in 2008, and that basically prevented the economy from crashing out completely. But now, of course, the governments are now indebted, and they can't cover their and they can't basically pay their way because they bailed the banks out. And the possibility now is that the banks will collapse now, having had all of the government money poured down their throats. They're going to collapse and leave us with nothing. Of course, what's basically happening is a massive redistribution of wealth to the tiny elite which control the system, and they are getting richer as we speak. I mean, they're not suffering at all. In actual fact, as the economy goes down, they're making profit on the back of it going down. But the rest of us are going to have to pay the consequences.
Do you think it's fair to say that, particularly in the mainstream press, in newspapers, national newspapers, broadcasters, that there's a real nervousness about talking the economy down?
Well, it is all about confidence, of course. So therefore, your central bank governors and chancellors of the exchequer and so forth try to talk the economy up, because that's part of their job. But I don't think there's much sense for people sitting where we are to try and convince ourselves by whistling in the dark. We need to be absolutely clear what's going to happen. The system, we should have reformed the system years ago, but there's basically inertia in people's thinking. They're only willing to challenge the system when the system fails. If we'd actually challenged the system years ago and restructured it, then we wouldn't be in the mess we're in. But it takes a shock before people are prepared to do the necessary things. In 1933, when Franklin Roosevelt came to power, the Depression had been running for 3 years at that stage, and he came to power with a determination to reform the financial system and basically to reboot the economy through government expenditure. Obama came to power having bailed the banks out and then stalled, didn't do anything. And that was the opportunity that the world had to sort the mess out. We didn't take it, and now we're going to pay the consequences.
So do you think it's fair to say, as I was talking about the media just now, that actually there's a really wide spectrum of experts in this, you know, people who are actually working in the City of London, working in other financial markets in other parts of the world, that have just got, you mentioned the word inertia there, that they really don't want to believe that they're going about to go off the cliff, and that actually makes things worse?
Well, I mean, if you're in denial about something, then it's obviously it doesn't help when reality bites you on the bum, does it?
They've got time and money and effort has all been invested in a system which is no longer actually functioning properly.
Well, it's functioning for those who are benefiting from the way it works. Basically, what we've been doing is been printing money to prop up the stock market. That has not filtered down to ordinary people. Ultimately, the only way to break the back of a recession or depression is massive government expenditure. And what I would suggest is that instead of saying we can't afford this, we can't afford that, we need to make a list of things that we need. For example, we might need a whole new generation of nursery schools. I would suggest that we might. The Prince Charles the other day was suggesting community service for young people. Now, I'm not saying that we should be a compulsory community service, but let's think about why don't we put all of these young people to work to do something? Maybe, you know, looking after youth centres, whatever. We need to have a list of things we want to do and do it. And say, well, where's the money going to come from? Well, the money's got to come ultimately from the wealthy classes. I'm afraid we can print money a little bit, you can wriggle around a bit by borrowing, but ultimately the wealthy classes have benefited enormously from the deregulation of financial markets. Many of them started off as millionaires, they are now billionaires. That money basically is the money we need to invest in the future of our children. And it's us or them, and I'm afraid it's got to be them. And that ultimately will be how it will have to be played out.
You studied politics, philosophy and economics at Oxford. Isn't there a philosophical side to this to a certain extent, in that you've got a proactive, or, you know, if you're actually looking at how you plan your economy, you can either decide what you want to do and then find the money to do it. And literally the government, the Treasury, can order the banks and order the central bank to do what it's told, or else you start managing the economy based on the amount of money supply you've got. There's really two ways of approaching the fundamental economic planning.
Ultimately, we have to reaffirm the necessity for a degree of economic planning. I'm not suggesting that we should plan everything. That would be silly. We don't want to try and get rid of the market economy completely, because that would be silly. But on the other hand, if you think about how Britain was managed from 1945 to, say, 1973, and most other countries as well, there was basically a mixed economy with a very strong state sector. And that was actually quite a stable setup. It allowed redistribution of wealth. The top rate of tax in the 1950s, for example, in both Britain and the US, was 96%. And that means basically that resources were available for the government to spend. Now, if we had the same tax system now that we had back then, we wouldn't have a deficit at all. But what's happened is that the wealthy classes have basically got out of paying taxes. And they've got out of paying taxes, and thus leaving the government with no resources to do the job it needs to do. Now, ultimately, this is silly. The system won't work unless the government gives it a good boot. And ultimately, that's what's got to happen. I mean, what the European Central Bank are now talking about doing, and European politicians are talking about doing, is everybody to cut back and have a rage of austerity. Now, this is silly, because ultimately, if everybody cuts back, the economy will just fall through the floor. And we've got to break this psychology that we've just got to keep cutting, we can't afford it. This is rubbish. We've got to actually decide what we want to do and do it. And we need a political will to do that. But that requires political movements. When Roosevelt came to power in 1933, he had a mass movement behind him. He got loads of people to agree with what he wanted to do. He won the election hands down, and then he got on with the job. Now, unfortunately, we've got a generation of politicians who've got used to the idea that the market is king, the market is God, you can't challenge the market. And basically, that's exactly what we've got to do. We've got to challenge the market God. And get rid of the idea that these financial markets that are run amok are the only way to organise society. They are not. In the past, stock markets were much less important than they are today. And there's no reason why we can't go back to a much more balanced system.
Well, psychology rather than philosophy, if you want. But I'm going to get back to this point. Isn't it that we're currently doing things where we're saying, well, we can't do this, based on budgetary considerations, rather than we need to do this.
That's right. And any country can produce anything which its people have got the skills to make. And economics is not a zero-sum game. All of these young people who are not working are dead weight on society. They're not actually, you know, it makes much more sense to pay to have them doing something than to pay them to do nothing. And this is just common sense, really. And the costs of not doing these things are so great. I mean, just think of all the costs of the riots the other week. I mean, just the financial costs, let alone the sort of trauma and psychological distress.
But surely these young people, a lot of them, are just on no benefits at all, so they're not actually being paid.
Well, you would have to analyse what sort of benefits they were or were not on. I mean, basically, it's fairly clear that what we're talking about here are young people from poor areas. And basically, a whole generation is staring at a future which doesn't exist. I mean, they've got no hope whatever, and that's just insane. We've got to give young people hope, and basically, there's loads of things that need doing. So let's do them. Let's put them to work to do those things. I mean, construction be obvious thing to boost. Infrastructure needs to be rebuilt, and I would suggest there's lots and lots of things that we can do for people, like community centres. Nursery schools, looking after old folks. Yeah, I mean, we should just do those things, pay people to do those things and pay them properly.
But then
that's what you have to do.
The inevitable question is, where is the money going to come for that?
The money is going to come from, we're going to have to rebuild the tax system. It's as simple as that. The government can't just print money. That is the road to disaster. You can, to a certain extent, borrow, but we've already reached the limit on that because we bailed the banks out. And then we go and borrow from the same banks that we've bailed out, and they charge interest to lend us the money. This is nuts. Basically, the banking system should be properly nationalised. And at the end of that, you say, well, we're not actually ever going to have private banks again. We haven't got private banks at the moment. The private banks basically have been propped up by the state, and they're pretending to be private banks, and they're pretending to make profits. In actual fact, there are no real profits because a lot of the stuff they've got on their books is actually junk. But they've been allowed to market to magic rather than mark to market, and so they can pretend they're making a profit and they can pay themselves big bonuses and they pay out
the
shareholders.
Isn't this sort of auditing fraud? Because point out is that people said that wasn't possible because of these massive companies surely couldn't be fraudulently coming up with stuff. But then we had Enron, didn't we?
Well, exactly. And what happens with Enron is once they started using fraudulent accounting, all their competitors had to use fraudulent accounting as well. Otherwise, they get left behind. So what happens by Goldman Sachs, for example, selling kited derivatives through the front of the shop and betting against them from the back of the shop?
Okay, what is a kited derivative?
Well, a derivative is a complex financial instrument. It's basically a bet, and what was actually happening is that they were selling derivatives in the front end of the shop, which were designed to fail, and the senior management at Goldman Sachs were actually betting against their own derivatives in secret, and that is fraud. There's no other term for it. It's fraud. And of course, they were doing that, therefore all their competitors have to do similar things to stay in the game, and very soon the whole system becomes fraudulent. Now, this is also an opportunity, of course, because if they're all fraudulent, and they are, then you can arrest a lot of them and confiscate all their assets. We need James Galbraith, the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, the famous US economist. He has pointed this out and said, look, what we need to do is we need to put a lot of these guys in prison and take their money off them. And that's and of course that seems unthinkable because we're talking about putting all of them in prison because they're all being involved in these fraudulent activities. But I'm afraid that if you can't do the time, don't do the crime. And I'm afraid, you know, the society as a whole cannot tolerate this kind of antisocial behaviour.
So what happens if we don't do that?
Well, what will happen is that we're going to have an almighty crash, and then people will wake up and realise that things have got to be changed.
And I suppose the longer it's put off, the bigger it'll be.
It will, yes, by propping the banks up in the way they have. This all started from the dot-com bubble in 2001. They started basically building more bubbles on the back of that. And you know, so the whole thing has been a virtual reality game for the last 10 years.
One of the ways that I know that the 9/11 attacks in 2001 affected it all was that there was a big dip after that, which convinced a lot of people to deregulate.
Well, exactly what they did was they should have allowed. What should have happened? There should have been a crash at that point. And that, if there had been a crash at that point, the capitalism might have regenerated itself. I think there is actually a big question mark over whether capitalism does just regenerate itself. Market fundamentalists believe that it somehow always manages to right itself. I suspect that that's not necessarily the case, and that once you've got yourself into a crash, there is no necessary way out of it. I mean, in theory, the economy, if prices fall enough, eventually somebody may decide that it's cheap enough to buy raw materials and labour to start making more stuff. But actually, the reality is probably that once you've got into a crash, there is no market way out. The only way out is for the government to grab the economy by the scruff of the neck and march it into the 21st century. And that's what needs to happen, not just in Britain, but over the whole world. But we're going to need a massive political movement to get that to happen.
Now, is it fair to say that the US and Wall Street is leading this difficulty?
Well, I mean, Britain has got a junior role with the City of London, but basically it is the American economy which has you know, the Washington consensus has been rammed down everybody's throats for the last 30 years, and it's turned out to be wrong. We should write it in fire, words of fire, 10 feet high. The free market philosophy is just wrong. It doesn't explain how the economy really works. The older view of the economy, the Keynesian view of the economy, the Marxist view of the economy, if you like, is the correct view. That is how it really works. The free market philosophy underlying the derivatives market is simply wrong. It's very complicated, and they've got lots and lots of fancy maths. But the fancy maths, there's only one problem with it. It's all wrong. And it doesn't matter how fancy the maths is, if it's wrong, it's wrong. And a lot of these derivatives basically are junk.
Now, we're going to be looking at the European Central Bank in a minute, and Europe particularly, and how we got here, really, in the last 10, 15 years. But many people point to the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 as one of the real problems in the United States, which really, apparently anyway, separated the power of the US Treasury from the Federal Reserve, making it really essentially a private, or a set of several private banks that were working together.
That is quite right.
Is that true?
Yes. I mean, essentially, the Federal Reserve is only about as federal as Federal Express. It's a private bank run by private bankers for private bankers. And basically, it allows them to game the system and keep themselves in the style to which they've become accustomed. It should be nationalised. And run in the public interest. So it should have been nationalised years ago.
The House of Representatives and the Congress and the President can huff and puff and stamp their feet, but they can't really, whilst it's in private hands, do much about it.
No, they can't, and there's no intention to do anything about it anyway. The politicians in the US are bought by the financial markets. Wall Street was the biggest contributor to Obama's campaign and will be the biggest contributor to anybody else who's going to be elected. And Goldman Sachs were the biggest of Wall Street investors to pay into the Obama campaign. So Obama, who ought to have been the man to take on the banks, turned out to be a man working for the banks. And that's the best we could hope for, because what we're likely to get now is a Republican winning the presidential election, and they're still wedded to this crazy free market philosophy. But of course, they are going to have a nasty shock, because if they carry... I mean, the Tea Party people in the Congress nearly crashed the world economy a couple of weeks ago. They're that stupid. And I'm afraid with those kind of people in charge, there's no hope whatever.
And that
we're
was
just going to crash the economy.
They were saying that they would refuse to pass the budget unless certain things were done, and that is really to reduce the debt ceiling.
They're just talking about we've got to cut government expenditure. Well, I mean, the first thing, what you need to do is nationalise the banks, break the military-industrial complex, withdraw from Afghanistan, withdraw from Iraq, stop trying to interfere in other people's countries, save yourself a lot of money on that, and then rebuild the infrastructure inside the United States with the resources that you would free up. But they're not prepared to do that because there's a criminal ruling class that's got a criminal agenda. And I'm afraid we're going to have to take them on. Politically... And in any other way that we may need to take.
I mean, surely the Tea Party were right in a way that what could help all this is to massively cut the Pentagon budget.
Well, the Tea Party haven't talked about cutting the Pentagon budget. They're just talking about cutting healthcare. I mean, this is the absurdity of the situation. And it's obvious to a child that you can't spend all your money on bombs and then expect to live well. It's just not reasonable. And, you know, the time has come for us to take back our societies and run them in the interests of the ordinary folks. But that requires commitment. It requires political will. It requires a mass movement. Now, I'm hoping that as we go into the crisis, eventually this mass movement will appear. But we know what happened in the 1930s. You get mass movements, but they're not necessarily the ones you want. You get fascist mass movements. You get fundamentalist mass movements. People don't always act rationally. And the danger is that we're going to go into a 1930s-style crunch and then probably into a 1940s-style war. Big one. And I think this is absolutely tragic. And it's an insult to Britain's war dead in two world wars that all of this stuff has been done all over again. All the stupid things that we did in the past and we said we would never do again, we've done them again. How appalling.
Okay, let's look at Europe. And one of the things that really set the groundwork for the European Central Bank and was the formation of the European Community, the European Union. But before that, there was a very important conference, wasn't there, after the Second World War, the Bretton Woods Conference. Why was that called?
Well, the Bretton Woods Conference was formed in 1944, basically to create the financial architecture for the post-war world. And a system was created with the dollar as the core of the system, linked to gold, and basically allowing countries to manage their economies in terms of full employment internally. And that was a golden era. If you look back from the 1940s to the 1970s, everybody was scared that there was going to be further economic problems. But they discovered that if the government intervened and started to balance the economy by creating more, public services and so forth, it actually made the economy work. And if you think about the improvement in living standards from the 1940s to the 1970s, that was when we had a managed capitalist system. But what's happened since then, the Reagan and Thatcher era, I mean, modern conservatives still go on about the achievements of the Thatcher era. There were no achievements of the Thatcher era. The British economy was absolutely smashed during that period, and we're still living with the consequences. I mean, people have just got to grow up and face up to the fact that most of all that stuff was just wrong. It was rubbish. It was intellectually incoherent. The Black-Scholes theorem, which underpins the derivatives market, basically is dross. Myron Scholes, who invented the Black-Scholes theorem, himself said a couple of years ago that we must blow up or burn the derivatives market immediately, otherwise it will crash the world economy. Now, he ought to know, because he invented them, but nobody's listening. Okay. Nobody's listening.
Okay, back to 1944 for a minute, though. There were several institutions created at that point. There was already something called the Bank for International Settlements around, which is based in Basel in Switzerland. But then also created were the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Now, how are those two different? What's the difference between them?
Well, the International Monetary Fund essentially lends relatively short-term, to governments, so that they can, if they need to roll over their debts or whatever. But it then tends to impose on those governments the Washington consensus of free markets, privatization, etc. The World Bank has got a more long-term role in theory. It lends for long-term investments in big projects. But effectively, they are supposed to be the public sector. The IMF and the World Bank are both supposed to be public sector banks.
When they lend
money, they're dominated by the private banking interests.
Okay, so when they're negotiating these loans, they're also saying to individual nations, "Well, this part of your infrastructure, we want that.
Well, what's happening in Greece at the moment is they're saying, "Right, you've got to have massive austerity, and everything that isn't nailed down, you must sell to us at rock bottom prices." So what's actually happening is that the sharks in the financial markets are now intending to loot everybody's public wealth. So all the public lands in Greece, the infrastructure, it's all up for grabs for a song. Because, of course, if you have to sell everything all at once, then you're only going to get a rubbish price for it. It's a fire sale. Basically, what we're seeing is a takeover of power by a financial oligarchy backed by the military-industrial complex. It's evil. It's wrong. Something's going to have to be done about it. But as Aristotle pointed out many, many moons ago, what tends to happen is democracy tends to end up as oligarchy, because the wealthy in the society get greedy, they get pushy, and they eventually decide that they're going to take over. And that's effectively what's happening. With this super Congress in the US is going to decide everything. The elected representatives won't even get a look in. And the same will happen in Greece, the same is happening in Ireland, the same thing will happen here. And ultimately, we've got to reassert the right of ordinary people to have their interests looked after by the powers that be. It's a big struggle. It always was a big struggle.
Now, the European Central Bank was created as something as a result of the Maastricht Treaty. Yeah. Now, Mrs. Thatcher, one of the things she said in 1990 was, "I refuse to hand over this sovereign nation to 13 unelected bankers," and she was rather quickly removed. But then John Major then did sign the Maastricht Treaty, which created the European Central Bank. It was signed on the 7th of February, yeah, 1992, and the bank was created very quickly after that. So what exactly is the European Central Bank?
Well, it's a central bank for Europe, as its name suggests.
Because all those currencies kind of collapsed into the euro, didn't they?
Yes. I mean, the problem with the European Central Bank is that they've only got an inflation target. They haven't got an employment target. So basically, they are restricting the money supply in order to try and keep inflation down, whereas what we really need to do is invest for the future.
Now, it seems strange to me that the bank is headquartered in Frankfurt, Germany, and also the German economy seems to be doing better than any of the other economies.
The German economy is now dead in the water. In the last couple of weeks, it's become clear that they're dead in the water as well. So all that's
Germany's got a massive manufacturing base, which we don't have, for example.
Their economy is only growing at about 1% now. And of course, everybody was, you know, people talk about this as if, Germany's going to be all right, China's going to be all right, India's going to be all right. Nobody's going to be all right. Nobody. We're all in this together. We literally are all in this together.
Now, round about the sort of mid part of August 2011, we had a news story that Van Rompuy is tipped to chair a new economic government. This is an agreement between Angela Merkel and Nicolas Sarkozy. The French chiefs of France and Germany have got together to create what is an economic government.
Well, what you've got. A European government. What we've got is a load of squabbling children, basically, and that's not what you really need in a situation like this. I mean, we need a minimally. We need a European wide reflationary program, but that is not on the cards at the moment. They're all talking this talk about austerity. Austerity will crash. You know, basically, we're driving down the tunnel, and but we need to stop and go and reverse and do something else. But we're not going to do any of that.
Because we've figured out that halfway through the tunnel that actually the other end's blocked off.
Yes.
We're going to have to turn around.
Yes, I mean, basically, there is no way that you can't cut your way out of a recession. You can't. It's just impossible. It's a logical impossibility. And basically, what's got to happen is that the banks have got to take the hit. The wealthy classes have got to lose an awful lot of money. Mind you, they've made an awful lot of money, so they can afford to lose an awful lot, and they're just going to have to lose it. That's just the way of it.
Okay, so why is it that we've had, you know, we've got very different economies, I know, in different countries in Europe that are part of the Eurozone. Why are people now talking about the possibility that the Eurozone might fracture and break into different currencies?
Because having one currency for so many different kinds of economy with very different kind of levels of development is a recipe for disaster unless you have big fiscal expenditures. So you know, Germany basically should be spending a lot of money building the infrastructure in Greece, because that could work. But
is it a tension then between economic policy and political expediency for each of these different countries?
It's very difficult to get any agreement to do anything when you've got lots and lots of different people, you know, different governments with different ideas. Ultimately, we need to have at least European-wide and probably worldwide reflationary program. And the politicians need to step up to the plate and lead the people in the right direction. But unfortunately, they're leading us in the wrong direction. All of these free market friendly politicians have got to be booted out, frankly. That's what the democratic system's for. Boot them out and get somebody who knows what to do.
For those people that have got money invested, is the best thing to do to just get out of the stock exchange? Can you, for example, could you buy yuans, the Chinese currency?
You probably could, but the smart money is all going into gold at the moment, which is a disaster. If everybody, you know, the gold price is shooting through the roof.
Is that actually a signal of disaster?
That's a signal of disaster, yes. Of course it is.
And the reason being that gold does hold its value better than bits of paper, I suppose.
Yes, but what it means is that nobody's investing in new factories, nobody's investing in new materials, nobody's investing in new things. They're all rushing to buy gold, and of course gold doesn't do anything. It just sits there. And this is actually, you know, a very bad sign of where we're going.
Okay, any last little bits of advice for somebody who actually has some money invested? I mean, obviously, many people have just got credit cards with big debts on, but if you've got some money invested either in a company or in a bank somewhere, what should you do with it?
Well, I've been told that people who've got money are buying physical gold, but I think what we really need to do is have a collective, it's not just a question of individual strategies, we need to have a collective attitude, and we can solve our problems.
Are you talking about a mass movement?
Yes, of course. Democracy has got to be made to work, and that's what it's all about.
And what if it doesn't?
Well, if it doesn't, we know the consequences. We saw Nazi Germany. We saw, the rise of evil. It's quite possible that we are going to have similar things happen in our lifetimes if we don't get a grip.
Okay, Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist. Thank you very much.